From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We've been exploring what we're calling the fractured culture. With so many TV channels and the breadth of the internet, what is popular with one group can go unnoticed by another. Today, video games. Gamers are not a unified group. Some are spider solitaire addicts. Others love Resident Evil. Heather Chaplin reports on one of the biggest and most intense video game subcultures.
The Final Fantasy series has sold 97 million copies around the world. But if you don't play it, you probably haven't heard of it. On a recent Tuesday, members of the NYU Game Club were hanging out, playing the latest installment in the 23-year-old franchise.
We're facing some sort of robot thing that is blocking our path in order to get to... Where are we going to? Who are we meeting right now?
That's Richard Rodriguez. He graduated from NYU last year, but he still gets together to play video games with his friends from the club, like Zeke Eberhoff.
One thing that's consistent across the series is an epic scale and operatic style to it.
As Rodriguez explains it, Final Fantasy is a role-playing game, or RPG, with origins in pen and paper games like Dungeons and Dragons. RPGs are all about heroic quests through richly drawn fantasy lands. Aesthetically, however, Final Fantasy XIII is a long way off from Dungeons and Dragons. Rodriguez describes it as lots of metal and robots in a Victorian city. The main character in Final Fantasy XIII is Lightning, a pink-haired, sword-wielding young woman out to save her sister who is in danger of losing her soul forever. Beyond that, the plot is too intricate to even begin to explain.
There's an element of world-building there.
Frank Lance is director of the NYU Game Center.
In the same way that you can disappear into Star Wars or disappear into Tolkien's universe, and it really rewards that kind of archaeological excavation where I'm just going to, like, go deeper and deeper into this piece of culture.
Frank Lance says the complexity of the game can discourage all but the most persistent.
It's so cool and seductive, the idea that there is this cryptic, mysterious, confusing thing that you have no idea. You're looking at it and you know that there's something going on there and you don't know what it is. And if you make the effort, you get to unlock that secret.
But then Richard Rodriguez is worried that the secret is being given away. New technologies like the Nintendo Wii Motion Control make it easier for anyone to play. You don't have to master a complicated set of buttons and joysticks.
I personally like that my mom didn't understand what buttons to press and how she couldn't play the games that I was doing. It was something that was unique to my personality, and it was something that I enjoyed doing that other people couldn't.
Then again, 67 million American households already play some kind of video game or another, so the days of games as a closed club may very well be over. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We've been exploring what we're calling the fractured culture. With so many TV channels and the breadth of the internet, what is popular with one group can go unnoticed by another. Today, video games. Gamers are not a unified group. Some are spider solitaire addicts. Others love Resident Evil. Heather Chaplin reports on one of the biggest and most intense video game subcultures.
The Final Fantasy series has sold 97 million copies around the world. But if you don't play it, you probably haven't heard of it. On a recent Tuesday, members of the NYU Game Club were hanging out, playing the latest installment in the 23-year-old franchise.
We're facing some sort of robot thing that is blocking our path in order to get to... Where are we going to? Who are we meeting right now?
That's Richard Rodriguez. He graduated from NYU last year, but he still gets together to play video games with his friends from the club, like Zeke Eberhoff.
One thing that's consistent across the series is an epic scale and operatic style to it.
As Rodriguez explains it, Final Fantasy is a role-playing game, or RPG, with origins in pen and paper games like Dungeons and Dragons. RPGs are all about heroic quests through richly drawn fantasy lands. Aesthetically, however, Final Fantasy XIII is a long way off from Dungeons and Dragons. Rodriguez describes it as lots of metal and robots in a Victorian city. The main character in Final Fantasy XIII is Lightning, a pink-haired, sword-wielding young woman out to save her sister who is in danger of losing her soul forever. Beyond that, the plot is too intricate to even begin to explain.
There's an element of world-building there.
Frank Lance is director of the NYU Game Center.
In the same way that you can disappear into Star Wars or disappear into Tolkien's universe, and it really rewards that kind of archaeological excavation where I'm just going to, like, go deeper and deeper into this piece of culture.
Frank Lance says the complexity of the game can discourage all but the most persistent.
It's so cool and seductive, the idea that there is this cryptic, mysterious, confusing thing that you have no idea. You're looking at it and you know that there's something going on there and you don't know what it is. And if you make the effort, you get to unlock that secret.
But then Richard Rodriguez is worried that the secret is being given away. New technologies like the Nintendo Wii motion control make it easier for anyone to play. You don't have to master a complicated set of buttons and joysticks.
I personally like that my mom didn't understand what buttons to press and how she couldn't play the games that I was doing. It was something that was unique to my personality, and it was something that I enjoyed doing that other people couldn't.
Then again, 67 million American households already play some kind of video game or another, so the days of games as a closed club may very well be over. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.
Social networks like Facebook and Twitter are helping people stay connected, but some observers worry that social networks are reinforcing our divisions by letting us hang out online with people who are just like us. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Dwayne Akins goes to Facebook to stay in touch with friends and family who, for the most part, share his political views. Akins lives in Oakland, California, and runs a nonprofit that focuses on health and fitness. He's generally liberal.
A lot of my friends are Democrats and liberals. I haven't really seen no Tea Parties, and I haven't bumped into no Republicans.
And Facebook's software may be reinforcing his tendency to only see links from people he agrees with. When Facebook shows you your top news, it guesses what you'll like based on how often you click on a particular friend's entries. Dean Eccles, a PhD candidate at Stanford who studies social networks, says most people don't click on posts when they disagree.
Because I'm not sure I want to register my disagreement with somebody. That may just not seem appropriate or like a fun experience. And so a service like Facebook can't really know that you want to see that there if you never click on the content and you never comment on it.
Facebook keeps you in your own group. In some ways, Twitter does as well, but it may connect you with people who you don't know, but who enjoy, say, the same TV show. If you look at trending topics on Tuesday nights, you might see a hashtag for The Game. It's a show on BET about a group of black football players and their personal lives.
Finally got himself a woman that knows how to take care of a ball player.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know what? I thought I had one of those. But she was all take and no care.
Dwayne Akins watches and tweets about The Game. He loves the show because it gets beneath stereotypes of black football players.
The show gives it the opportunity to be spoken about and to be made real. And some of the issues on the show might start movements or something like that.
A Twitter movement is what has kept The Game on the air. In 2009, the CW network canceled it. Angry tweets went out from the black community, says Kira Gaunt, a professor at City College and a TED fellow who's African American. Gaunt says the Twitter conversation focused on how little good programming there was about black life, even on BET. Gaunt says BET saw the chatter and picked up The Game.
I think there's a little bit of wishful, hopeful thinking that something might turn a corner with the way that BET mediates images of black people. We don't want a black version of MTV.
Among African Americans, Twitter is extremely popular. According to a study by Edison Research, 25% of Twitter users are black. Craig Watkins, a communications professor at the University of Texas, says young African Americans use Twitter because so many of them have cell phones and use them to communicate with friends. He says it's also the main entryway to the internet for many low-income blacks who don't have home computers and broadband.
And so that mobile device becomes a very sort of reliable way to do the kinds of things that they want to do online, if it's watching video, if it's updating their Facebook status, if it's using Twitter.
But even though there is a lot of conversation going on among African Americans on Twitter, Professor Gaunt says it's very different from the closed nature of Facebook because tweets are public.
It becomes about listening. Like, oh my God, I can listen in to what black people are talking about. Oh my God, they talk about that? Oh my God. And you can actually say something if you want.
When Gaunt realized people could talk back on Twitter, she decided to have conversations about race. She says it's been a really freeing experience because people are honest.
You can really have a conversation and not worry about getting punched in the nose. There's debate. There's engagement. There's learning about black people, even if you've never seen one before.
Gaunt says she's made new friends through Twitter.
I'm meeting strangers. I met with two people I had engaged with through Twitter in the past 10 days who I'd never met in real time, in what we say in IRL, in real life. And I met them, and I felt like, this is my tribe.
And Gaunt says they weren't black. But the key word for some observers is tribe. Although there are people like Gaunt who are using social media to reach out, some observers are concerned that she is the exception to the rule, that most of us will be content to stay within our race, class, ethnicity, family, or political party. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The latest now in our series on fractured culture. Today, a cable TV show that's very popular with one group of Americans, but completely unknown to just about everybody else. It's called iCarly, and it's on Nickelodeon. Never heard of it? Well, an episode of iCarly was one of the top 20 cable telecasts of the year in 2010. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, if you do know iCarly, there's a reason.
Roaming the mall at Pentagon City in Arlington, Virginia, it took me a while to find some iCarly fans.
I've never heard of it.
iCarly?
What was that?
Do you know iCarly?
No.
And then I scored.
My five-year-old niece is obsessed with iCarly, so she loves it.
The adults I talked to who do know iCarly were like 29-year-old Hector Jimenez from D.C. They spend time with kids.
And how about you?
I actually can get into it, yeah. They're constantly laughing, you know, with the different scenarios that take place.
iCarly is a sitcom about some young teenagers. Carly and her friend Sam have their own goofy web show.
Frog Punch asks, hey Carly and Sam, what's the proper way to cook a pickle with a blowtorch? Excellent question.
If you don't have any kids in your life, there is a chance that you don't know the show or haven't even heard of it.
Dan Schneider is iCarly's executive producer. He's worked with the tween audience for years. He created Drake and Josh and Zoe 101. Nickelodeon's target audience ranges from as young as 6 to 14. But Schneider says he tailors iCarly to older kids.
I felt like if I'm getting 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, then the younger kids are just going to come along for the ride because they want to do what their big sisters and brothers are doing.
Boys and girls alike watch iCarly. According to Nielsen, boys are about 45% of its audience. The male characters might explain its popularity with boys. Spencer is Carly's off-the-wall older brother.
Okay, will you get the milk?
Yeah, sure.
It's not in the fridge.
Ugh, you promised you'd stop drinking milk in the shower.
Stop trying to change me!
Spencer is also Carly's guardian. The parents are gone. In fact, you don't see grown-ups much on the show at all. In the same way Dan Schneider doesn't play down to young children, he also isn't playing to adults.
I have definitely avoided the parents in my shows, and I avoid adults as... Let's put it this way. I don't bring adults onto the show and have them be a drag because I want kids to love the shows. And the thing is, my shows are about kids and they're about kids winning and about kids taking power over their lives and doing cool, fun things.
And by appealing to kids, the parents often go along for the ride too, making iCarly a show that reaches a larger fracture than a lot of what you see on TV. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.